Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with 95-year-old Joe Reyes of Fresno, California, one of three brothers to serve in our armed forces. After arriving at Normandy's Omaha Beach about a week after the initial landings, he served in an M-15 half-track crew. Truck wheels in the front, tank tracks in the back, plenty of firepower aboard. And how many men in that half-track crew, Joe?
Well, there's seven altogether. One to operate the 37mm, two to operate the 50 calibers, vertical tracker and horizontal tracker, and I was a gunner. When I saw that we were probably getting a hit, why then I let loose with a 37mm. The 50 calibers are being fired by the cannoneers. They're feeding the 50 calibers machine gun. The other one is making sure feeding the 37mm. It's automatic. You don't have to load. You just got a cartridge of 10. And we just go right down as you're firing automatic with a 37mm gun. There was the sergeant in the driving compartment of the half track, and there's the driver, and there's five of us inside of the half track to operate the machine guns and the 37mm gun.
You mentioned Omaha Beach, so this is less than a week after the initial landing. You're D-Day plus six, early June 1944. Can you help us understand what you saw when you came ashore? What that whole scene looked like, sounded like, smelled like?
Oh, yeah. You know, the Corps has to pick up all the dead bodies, and according to their tags, they identified. We saw bodies still floating. It was something that you just can't bring it into mind. It's you can't say it's horrible. It's worse than that. The boys that survived that invasion, I don't think they'll ever be the same again. Their eyes, what they saw, what they felt, it's you can't explain what your eyes saw. It's to hell them back. That's what it is. It's the only way you can describe it. You know, to hell and back. I don't know if I can answer anymore.
Well, so you're seeing all this evidence of what's happened in the preceding days, and none of that's very encouraging. But then you're going to be fired upon as well. What was the first instance of that you experienced? What was the first hazard or danger to yourself that you realized?
Shoot them before they shoot me. Survive. You keep your wits and operate your guns properly, and don't be afraid. If you're afraid, don't show it. Just hide it and do your job, or else you're not going to be around. They're going to kill your position. So you don't even think about that. You're operating that gun and boom, 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 bang. And so not only my half-track, but the other half-tracks get them before they get me. That was a motto we had to do. We didn't even, when you're operating that gun, you don't think about dying. You only think about making accurate to make sure you knock down the planes. That was our motto.
Well, that's what I was going to get to. So you're the 473rd Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion. So your job is to shoot down planes. What was the first opportunity you had to do that? What was the first time you encountered enemy planes?
Well, we encountered them when our supplies were coming on board. We were positioned inland already. We had columns of material providing the war, guns, tanks, quartermaster. You know, they carry the food and all of that. And we'd be right there on besides the side of the road, all strung out. The whole battalion strung out like that, give them air cover. Sometimes we got them, and sometimes some of them was bound to sneak in. And the bay battery would get the most of it because they were way up ahead. But we made sure we stay alive by being accurate. If the planes were too far, we would shoot a barrage. And they never make it. The intent of that barrage was like 4th of July. They knew they couldn't get to that barrage, so they come down low. Right beside your gun position, you couldn't fire. You know, and then way over there, they come up.
And so these would be Messerschmitt 109s or the FW-190s who are diving and strafing you guys?
Messerschmitts and the Stuka and the Wolf. They had a bomber, and then they didn't try to bomb us. They just go right down, and you couldn't shoot at them. Our barrage was so intense. I mean, to tell you, they get hit before they even get to the target. We, instead of using my scope for the distance, just fire out there, try and get as close as you can to him because he's about 2 miles out and he's out of range on your mill screen. So you just fire above him and ahead of him. He's so far out, but still you can still get a hit. You get a still barrage, you're still effective.
So what you guys were doing, because of the strength of how many anti-aircraft guns you had, you were creating a wall of flak that they would have to fly through?
That's it, a wall of fire. And it was difficult for them to get through it. And they were getting hit. Well, like I said, they just died out, no. And you couldn't fire at them. They go by and they would wave, especially the ones on the bombers. They turn around there, you can see their face, and they wave like this, you know, give out the old salute, and we go like this.
You give them the one-finger salute?
One-finger story. Oh, we give him five.
Well, you can laugh about it now, but at the time, as a teenager, halfway around the world with bullets flying.
We were serious. I mean, to tell you, we were serious because we knew what their mission was, to try and hit the column, you know, that was going up to the front supplies, supplying some of the troops that were up there in front. You know, tanks were going up there to the front. Germans were retreating. They had some standoff, you know, but where it cost us a little lives, but we kept on going, and we all thought the same thing. Let's get this over with so we can go home.
Well, and you said earlier that there were a few moments where you weren't sure you were going to come home, where your brown Mexican skin turned white because you were so afraid. Now, is that hyperbole, or you think you really turned white?
Well, there was one airplane we hit, and I'm telling you, that plane didn't change direction. He came straight at a half track. And I say, hey, that guy is hit. Why is he coming straight? And then the first thought we said, he's committing suicide. Cover. And all we did was just cover like that because we didn't have time to jump into the slit wrenches. So we just cover like this, and whoosh, he went right by. He missed us by 5 feet. 5 feet, and we could smell the, you know, the air as it went by. He still had his bomb in there. He went by us and hit a building about 40 yards away. We could feel the concussion of the bomb, made a big hole over there. And then everybody on the battery was phoning on D battery, in our section. And some of the other sections, everybody was phoning to see if we were all right. They actually thought we got hit. You know, it came so close. And another time, still in supply lines. And we stopped for about, 5 minutes. Sometimes they stop. You got to follow the lead jeep where the colonel or the major is in. I felt the pain when... Oh, we stopped and we unlock our cannon. You lock it, keep it from going like this, you know, because there's so much play on the turret. Mm-hmm. So you lock it. First thing we did was unlock the gun. We turn it around so we had maybe a feel of fire there in case we were told to fire at will. All of a sudden, there was a ping! Cling, 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 and the doggone bullet came around inside of the half track, you know. Well, a sniper, the whiz in that bullet was going that way, because it hit the barrel of the gun on the very edge of the barrel, and I was right behind it. He missed me, and because he hit the barrel of the gun, whether maybe that much.
So you were less than an inch away from getting hit by that sniper's bullet.
And then I heard an infantryman say, "We'll get him." You know, the infantry coming up. It was already dusk. And he said, "We'll get him." I heard him say that.
So you're sitting in the half track behind the barrel of that gun. They shoot right at the barrel. It glances off the side and ricochets all throughout your half track, but never hits you.
I never did find that. I wanted to find that ricocheting bullet and never did find it. You know, I would have taken it as a memoir, you know. Well, my heart went boom, 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 man, you know. And, he missed me. It was a good thing. He would have hit me right here.
Right in the heart?
Yes, right above the heart. It would have hit me. I still think the barrel of that gun was in the way that we ricocheted off.
So you land in Normandy in June of 44. You go through the Normandy campaign. Where did you go from there?
We went to Belgium. We got to Belgium. We headed toward the front. Pat was up with the troops, you know, sometimes. You'll get right in there. We went up. It was a cold. You couldn't do zero. Infantry was going up. You could see it strung out one side to the other. Bazooka guys, you know, but the equipment, you couldn't travel through that snow. It was about, must have been about 8 feet high. So they could walk through the snow. And one of them said, "See those two guys over there? See, they're frozen. Two Germans are frozen." He says, "They were covered with a blanket." We took the blanket off, and there it is. Two Germans frozen to death. We asked each other, "What are we doing here with all those trees? And what are we going to use us as artillery?" "Can you even use us as artillery? We're not up in the front. We're way behind, and the trees are like Yosemite, you know. I mean, there was no place for us." Sure enough, about half or an hour later, there comes a jeep going right through beside the half tracks. And he stops at the leading column, you know, and turned us around, got out of there. They had no use for us. Airplanes, the weather, the way it was, neither side could fly because, you know, they wouldn't know where the bombs were going to land. We didn't have the equipment then that we have now, you know. All we had was radios. And
So you're talking about the Battle of the Bulge. The weather was so bad, the visibility was so low, that flying wasn't feasible until right around Christmas when that finally broke. At that time, did they move you guys back into position or no?
Yes, we went to Holland. We was laying our battery up, covering Patton's tanks going into Germany from Holland. Well, the Holland people were really grateful for the liberation. Some of us said, "If the Germans break through here, they'll send you back to the sea." Just like that Dunkirk from the British. And we were afraid of that. And if they come back and they know that we were friendly with the troops, he says, "We don't know what's going to happen to us." So it didn't happen. They were very grateful. It was a nice, beautiful place, Holland. I think it was better than even Paris. We loved that place. The people, are speaking English. A lot of them, most of them spoke English. Teachers were out there, professors and everything. And up ahead, you could hear the doggone firing, you know, of the infantry. And they didn't care. We were being liberated. They came out there, the bullets were bouncing everywhere, and they didn't care. Welcome the Americans, you know. So we covered Patton. It wasn't long. A week, then we went into Germany. We were about 15 miles on the superhighway, Autobahn, they called it. They stopped us. Germans had given up. British from the left over there, the Russians from over there, and a stream of people coming back from Germany to the American side. They didn't want nothing to do with the Russians. They didn't know what to expect from the Russians, because of the war that Germany had caused Russia at that time. So maybe they were out for revenge and they didn't want nothing to do with them. So there's a stream of refugees coming to the American sectors. Well, war was over. They brought us home. We wanted to see Berlin, actually. We waited. We were then sent back to England on barges. We waited in England for about 3 months. Finally, they sent us home.
But that journey home would not be quite as smooth as he expected, not on the water and not on land once he got home to California. I'm not sure you've heard a story quite like his homecoming story before. We'll circle back to his time in Europe, too. And wait until you hear 95-year-old Joe Reyes sing. I guarantee you've never heard this song before. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.